Hello, friends. This is Michael Bohm with Youth Apologetics Training. Today, we're going to have Dr. Charles Jackson back on the podcast, a.k.a. Dr. J, and we're going to be talking about junk DNA today. What is it? How is it used as an argument against creationism? And, why it really can't be used as an argument against creationism, but rather an argument for a designer, a very intelligent designer, God. And so, again, this is Dr. J, or Dr. Charles Jackson, of creationtruth.com. Dr. J, welcome to the Youth Apologetics Training Podcast.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
So, friends, tonight we're going to be talking about junk DNA. Dr. J, what is junk DNA, and why is this often used as an argument against creationism?
Well, just like junk organs were once used as an argument in favor of evolution and against God's design, the designer's obviously incompetent if he gave us all these organs that don't do anything. But the myth was that these organs didn't do anything. Since we figured, since we're so smart, and we couldn't figure out what the organs were doing, then they must not be doing anything. And, of course, this was arrogant and myopic. It made us miss the mark. It was a bad, bad blind spot. And then history repeated itself once we found out all these organs really did have purposes and functions during our lifespans. Then they did the exact same thing once they found a new realm in biology where there was a lot that was unknown, and they just annexed that and said that these unknown things are really proof of evolution. And Dr. Gary Parker once said that evolution thrives in the uncertainties, and he was right. They just pick up on things that we don't know enough about, and then later, when we find out the rest of the story, it is something that's completely not useful to evolution or actually condemning of evolution.
Right. I think I remember reading in Dr. Jerry Bergman's book, he referred to it as disteleology, an idea that basically if they don't know what an organ or something does, they try to use that as an argument for God's imperfect design, and therefore an argument against God.
Oh, my, you have been reading up on this.
Well, I try, but I do find the subject a little bit intimidating because it's just, boy, it gets so technical. It gets so technical. So this junk DNA, from what I understand, there are, in our genetics, there are coding segments that code for proteins, and then there's everything else. And I guess the coding segments are only about 5% of our entire DNA. Then 95% is this non-coding that is often referred to as junk DNA. Is that right?
Yeah. Actually, for the longest time, it was just 2% that we knew what it was doing. The reason that we knew what it was doing for so long was that these were the genes in our chromosomes, in the nucleus of our cells. These were the genes that had the DNA that was coding to make proteins. And since they actually made something, you could kind of trace it back. You could trace all these proteins back to the gene on whatever chromosome that actually had the code, the recipe for making that protein. But the rest of the DNA, we couldn't find what it was doing because it wasn't making proteins, so it didn't kind of like leave a retraceable trail.
Right. So I guess as I was reading about this, I almost got this image in my mind of, okay, so there's the coding segments that make proteins, and that would be almost like analogous to the raw materials that you would use to build a building. So like your bricks, your mortar, your steel, your aluminum frames, the drywall, the copper wiring, all these things. So you've got all the building materials, the proteins, but without instructions, specific instructions on how to put it together, the timing of putting it together, you really don't have a whole lot. And it sounds like that's where the rest of this alleged junk DNA comes in.
It's kind of like when we didn't know as much and we couldn't figure out as much, it was easier to conjure up ideas that were wrong. Like, before we knew more about the movements of the sun, the moon, and the stars, it really did look like the sun goes around us. I mean, from the Earth, it actually looks that way. But when we really got into the observations, even before telescopes were used, we realized that that wasn't what was true. We had to look at it a lot more carefully, get a whole lot more information, but then it became really clear that the Earth goes around the sun, and we're one of the planets that do that. Well, the same thing with the junk DNA. I mean, it's not just the building materials that the proteins are, but every hormone in your body is a protein. Every enzyme in your body is a protein. You know, lactase, which digests lactose, milk sugar, if people are lactase deficient, that is a protein. It's an enzyme that digests milk sugar, but it is a protein too. So there are many other growth hormones and things. Not only are proteins the building materials for your body, by and large, but other protein molecules conduct the events of building your body and maintaining all of your tissues. So there are a lot of different forms of proteins in the body, but it's weird that we could trace all these things back and only figure out what 2% of the DNA was doing. We just figured the rest, well, the only truth was the rest, we just didn't know what it was doing. The assumption was made, since we can't figure out what it's doing, it must not be doing anything. And immediately, like with the junk organs, the vestigial organs, the evolutionists jumped on this and said, well, this is just old leftover DNA from back in the day when we were fish and worms and rats, and we don't use that fish, worm, and rat DNA anymore. Some of it we do, but most of it we don't. And it's just clutter in the attic from past lives we once had. And so they just wove this intricate story about it, truly knowing zero about what they were saying, weaving a beautiful evolutionary tale exactly the way they did about the vestigial organs, and they made the exact same mental blunder. Now, I could say mistake or error, but doing it again just shows how blindly evolutionary believing scientists will charge full speed ahead towards something that if you had been thinking about it while you were going in that direction, you'd realize it was just about as stupid a thing you could possibly do and say, especially in the light that you'd made the exact same mistake a few generations before and ended up looking bad and being very, very bad for your reputation, very, very bad for your theory that's beloved. And I just cannot believe the drive to just do insipid things, and they keep it up. And so here they're doing it again with the junk DNA, and they did it for 40 years. Of course, all the time, creationists were saying, God doesn't make junk. These organs have functions. We just don't know what they are yet. We found them all. And then we all said that God doesn't make junk. This DNA is being transcribed. It's being converted into other forms. The chromosomes are taking the energy to copies of all this DNA in every cell of your body and then pass it down to the next generation. If it's really useless, even if there was no God, certainly evolution wouldn't waste time and energy and resources on something as meaningless as that, just like God wouldn't. But because it was so powerful and they found it to be so convincing to students to say that this was leftovers from our evolutionary past, they just wouldn't let go of it, and they never bothered to scrutinize it like we did, because, of course, we went from the position the biblical worldview in science that that these created things were designed, and therefore there's a designer, and you design them that way with a rhyme or reason in mind, not blindly. So our biblical science worldview was actually far superior at predicting the truth. And their worldview, the evolutionary secular worldview on the DNA, was actually what caused a very, very powerful blind spot. And they couldn't even let their minds go in the direction of what it turned out to be the truth.
So in other words, it sounds like just like in the case of vestigial organs, this theory of junk DNA actually hindered scientific progress.
Oh, absolutely. If we had actually given any credit to this, to these DNA sequences as having any value or purpose or function, we'd have figured out about the amazing differences between chimp brains and human brains. We'd have figured out that gene activity was far more important in many instances, like brain development, than was what the gene actually said, because there are other genes that don't actually make proteins, but they are the ones telling all the other genes that do make proteins when to make the proteins, how much to make the proteins, what quantities, and how long to be active, and what time in your life you're going to need those proteins, what time of the day you're going to need these proteins. It's how all of this gene activity in producing these proteins was coordinated was actually found to be centrally located in the junk DNA. The junk DNA was actually the nerve center, the command center, the secret to the coordination of the activity of all the other genes, well, all the 2% of them, and so it's really the disk operating system of your protein manufacturing.
Okay, and so other than just we don't know what it does, therefore it must be junk, do they have any other arguments before we look into what's actually happening and destroy this idea of junk DNA? Is there anything else they grapple with to try and show that it is, in fact, junk?
Well, the biggest proof they had was evolution just shows us. You see, evolution predicts that there would be a bunch of junk in there. And so they just saw that they had a double check on this system, that, well, evolution says it should be there, and there it is, not doing anything, just like evolution says it should. And so they just kind of, as we might say, robbed Peter to pay Paul, or they actually, it's a circular argument, but they just repeated it so much, the mantra, that to them, the greatest proof that it was junk is that evolution is true, and so, you know, get with it, everybody else, or we know what we're talking about.
So they just have this tautology, this circular argument that, you know, look, it has this junk DNA has predictability as far as, it, you know, evolution predicted that there would be junk. Hey, look, there's junk, therefore this must be true, and it is true.
Yeah, it's very, very dogmatic.
Okay, so tell me about ENCODE, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, the ENCODE project.
Well, there were a lot of different scientists all around the world working on that. Eric Lerner was one of them, worked at MIT and Harvard. He worked on the chimp genome project. This is something a little separate from the human genome project, but the ENCODE project was looking not just at listing the genome, but finding out how it works. And not only the junk DNA myth being dispelled by their work, but they also found out that the way that the genes, the way that the DNA is actually encoded is far more complex than we thought. We used to think that one gene got read from the beginning of the gene to the end of the gene, and that made that protein, and that's the end of the story. Now we realize many of the genes, if you read them backwards, they also make a protein that you need. And if you just read part of it and then read part of another gene and then splice them together, that will make another protein that you need. And John Sanford's work in his book, his reporting and talking about it in his book, Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, he was suggesting that there were codes nested within codes, nested within codes, nested within codes, kind of like that Da Vinci Code book talked about how the Bible had secret messages and who was going to be president every year and stuff like that. They tried going every certain number of letters in the Bible, and they claimed it was spelling out these things. I don't really know that much about that, so I can't comment on that. But the genetic code, not only if you just went every nucleotide base in order, but maybe went a certain number, every fifth one or something, that one would also spell out the code for a useful protein. Most people know that the DNA molecule is a double helix. It's like a twisted rubber ladder. It's that shape. And the two spirals, like two snakes wrapped around each other. And that in between them are the steps in a ladder, and that's where the code is in every one of those steps. But we always thought that there was just one strand of the DNA that's wrapped around the other one, and that one strand is where the real important message is. So we called that the code, the sense strand, and the other one the antisense strand. Well, now we find out the antisense strand also, all its information is being used too. So we just blew the lid off how simple we thought the whole system was. It's a hitherto for not understood yet complex network of laying and overlaying codes that overlap each other. In many cases, segments from a dozen genes, from a dozen different chromosomes, somehow all coordinate with each other to make one protein. It's an incredible accessing system, more sophisticated than any of our computer systems that we've got, our CDs or thumb drives or anything like that. So that was one of the big things the ENCODE project came up with, was it was way more complex and networked than we'd ever imagined. And they never mentioned this, but if you tweak a system that's so fine-tuned already, the only thing you're really going to do is mess it up. You change one thing, and 200 other things could all be messed up. Now there's backup systems, there are repair systems, there are things that can compensate. But as we've over the generations gotten more and more mutations in our DNA, these systems are obviously not working as well ever since Adam and Eve, of course, and so. The fact that this whole thing is so complicated and that evolution depends on accidentally changing the system and having a bunch of lucky accidents so that copying errors in the DNA can change a bacterial cell into a fish, and that fish can change into a rat or a possum, and that possum can change into people. I mean, it was already astronomically far-fetched to believe accidents, billions of accidents, could actually change bacteria into people. Well, now that we find out how intricate and well-tuned and networked the system of our DNA is, it's hard to actually explain how unscientific that kind of thinking is. In light of the data we now have, it seemed like a good idea back in Darwin's day before we even knew what chromosomes were. And it seemed like it could still be okay back in the 1950s when we believed one gene, one trait, and the very simplistic ideas, things that were brought about by many ingenious people in the past. But now we found out it's 100 times, 1,000 times more complicated than we thought. The system accidentally being tweaked throughout the generations, getting better, is again, it's hard to find a word for it. I just don't understand why, now that we know so much, some people's brains could stay so frozen in a disproved genetic idea like the evolutionary view of looking at DNA. I kind of ranted, but I hope that's what you wanted.
Yeah, absolutely. So one book I was reading says that we have somewhere around 25,000 human protein coding genes, but on record, in public databases, there are currently about 2.5 million human protein sequences. In other words, we've got the genes to code for about 25,000, but yet there's 2.5 million different proteins, human proteins. And so what's happening is God has created like the perfect code that allows for, there's no extra information. There's not, it's as if the Lord has put it in place where certain proteins, it'll take some of that code and splice it to other code in order to make certain proteins. Most of the proteins come from splicing code.
That's the only way you could get so many proteins from only these 22,000 genes. But of course, it's brilliant. It's just stellar. The mind that conceived this kind of a system. It's like merging thousands of tiny files, merging files together to make a book, and then merging the same files together in different order to make a different book. But these files are set. But they can be read forward, backwards, and get different information, and then coordinate that system to create whatever you basically want. So duck DNA is actually what makes it possible for us to get millions of proteins out of only a couple, well, really 22,000 coding genes. They are really being, we're getting our nickel out of these genes, because they're being utilized by a brilliant, ingenious system that is in place that coordinates using segments of each of these and putting them back together again in different ways. It's unimaginable, but we found out it was true. Eric Lander said, all the new data that came in, and we're talking in the year 2007, the year 2012, he said, it just blows my mind. And of course, it blew everyone's minds. But what's been a little overlooked is that creationists have been saying that there wasn't junk DNA all this time, that when they discovered there's no such thing as junk DNA, and there never has been, they said, no one predicted that this would be the case, which really actually infuriated me, because we've been saying it for 40 years, and then they had the gall to say that all this time no one had predicted what we had predicted, what they had ridiculed us for predicting, what they had mocked us for predicting. I had two professors mocking me at a college where I was teaching back in the 1996 for saying that junk DNA someday would find a purpose for it. And then to say no one predicted it when they knew we predicted it. And so, you know, they might try to hide from everybody and even from themselves that the creation model was years, generations ahead of them in predicting the nature of the genome, but the fact still remains, we were. Our biblical worldview, our deistic, theistic worldview against the atheistic worldview had us on course, and they were off wandering in the wilderness. Only when more facts came in were they able to let go of the junk DNA idea, and they acted like they were brilliant for finding this out. We had already told them this is what was going to happen.
Right. So I guess another analogy, I'm not sure if this is going to work very well, but you brought up the Da Vinci Code, and I think you were making reference to like what some people teach is the Bible Code, which I've never done a podcast on because I feel like there's so much hokiness that goes on in that area that it's really hard to tell what is legit and what isn't without actually vetting it myself. But the concept, all right, just get the concept. I've heard it said, and again, I've never vetted this out, but that something along the lines of the first two books of the Bible, Genesis and Exodus, if you go every 49th letter and you grab that letter and go 49 letters, grab that letter, it all the way through Genesis, I've heard that it spells Torah over and over and over. Deuteronomy, Numbers and Deuteronomy, I've heard that if you do that same thing, it spells Torah backwards, almost like arrows pointing in. And then I heard that Leviticus, every seven letters, you grab that letter and it says Yahweh. Now, again, I've never vetted that out, but let's just imagine that was true for a second. You basically, you've got the overarching theme of the Bible. You've got everything that the first five books of the Bible say, but then you've almost got this little sub-message that's hidden in the text that through what is referred to as, I think it's equidistance letter sequencing or something like that, they're able to find other messages. I know it's actually really borderlining on mysticism and really Kabbalah, which is Jewish witchcraft. But I'm just saying the concept, that concept, if you were to add to the Bible or take away from the Bible in any of those areas, it completely screws up the message. And so likewise, this DNA code is so complex, so jam-packed with information, and is able to produce so much from actually relatively short code by splicing different portions together, transposable elements. I want to ask you about that here in a few minutes. You really can't mix up any of those genes before you start having complete chaos and things don't work.
So we have to remember it's an article of Christian faith that the author of the Bible is God, not men. And
right.
So the same author that wrote the Bible wrote this DNA arrangement, the DNA code, and all of the information that's encoded in it for every living thing on the earth. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me. I'm not an authority on the Bible code or anything like that. I've heard of many things like that, that Jewish letters, Hebrew letters, are numbers. The numbers are letters, and you can get a number for the letters and add up and they always add up to a multiple of 7, 49, you know, 7 times 7. And those are all fascinating things to me. I'm not studied that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was that message within a message within a message within a message, just like the DNA is. It still comes from a mind whose ways are higher than our ways and thoughts are higher than our thoughts. And I might mention that Richard Dawkins, probably the most high-profile atheist in the world, he said that if there was a God, if there was a God, this God would have to be so far above us that merely trying to conceptualize him would be sheer madness. I agree with Richard Dawkins on that. And just these kind of evidences of what kind of a mind we're dealing with when we're talking about the mind of God, it's just so enormously complex, sophisticated, brilliant, and all you can do is stand in awe at the genome and at the Bible.
Amen. I also read about transposable elements. What do you know about that? Or jumping genes, they're also referred as.
Well, during replication and during the functioning of the DNA throughout the life of a cell, there are parts of the DNA that can be lifted out of the strand, turned backwards, and put right back in again, and it really doesn't affect the gene to do this. It's still, it's like taking the train out of a train, taking one of the cars out, turning it backwards and linking it back in with the other cars again, it might be going backwards, but it's doing everything that it used to do, and there's no real problem with it. And these things, there are certain parts, certain junctures along the DNA sequence where this is more liable to happen, just because the, well, for lack of a better word, the little hitches are more jumpable and can unhitch and then go back in backwards like that. Viruses can do things like that to DNA sequences, but you can look at these transposons, these transposable elements, transposed sections in the DNA of living people, and it's just like any other thing that kind of marks it. You can kind of trace the ancestry of us through the streams of civilization, as one Christian-based history book went, and trace it all back to the Middle East and to the cradle of civilization and all. But these things are interesting. There's something a creationist and an evolutionist would both find fascinating with how the DNA works, but it doesn't normally come down on either camp's side as proof that they're right. Evolutionists try to annex it, but they try to annex anything that's neutral as saying, since evolution, if evolution is true, this would happen, and since it happened, evolution is true. Well, there's, you know, 50 other ways that could happen without evolution ever being true, and they never tell the public that. I hope I kind of got to the thing you were hoping I'd get to.
So, didn't ENCODE get shut down because the ENCODE project, didn't it get shut down because they were giving results that didn't quite fit with the paradigm that they wanted?
Well, gee, I never heard that. I read all the results that were coming out in 2012 in some of the journals and in the popular reporting of the journals, like the New York Times and the Washington Post, and, you know, things that were reported from Nature magazine and all that. I didn't actually hear that ENCODE was shut down because it was all the findings were alarming many evolutionists to thinking this was bringing out their soft underbelly. I do know that Mark Armitage out at, Cal State, he found soft material in a triceratops horn, and that didn't look good for evolution, so they fired him. It was a discovery. He was fired for discovering something, a fact, an observation, but because it was an embarrassment to the evolutionists, and they were already very little rubbed raw about the T-Rex blood found by Mary H. Schweitzer back in 2006. Well, it's just 2005. They just retired to that, so they didn't want to hear any about the discoveries. I didn't realize that ENCODE had suffered a similar prejudice as Mark Armitage had.
I'm not 100% sure on that. I downloaded a bunch of podcasts on junk DNA today and listened to them while I was at work, and I'm pretty sure I remember hearing ID the Future podcast. One of them mentioned that it was shut down because their findings were not supporting the evolutionary junk DNA paradigm. And so they defunded it, and it just kind of fell apart.
Well, my one comment is, too late. It's already been done. And they just concluded, there's no junk DNA. There never was. All this time we talked about it, we were talking about something that wasn't real. And yeah, the embarrassing part, which I didn't see in much of any of the literature, was that they said it with such certainty, with such firmness and conviction, and making the connection that it just shows how superior evolutionary thinking is in science. You see this all fits together so beautifully. But they really were only arguing from the position of non-knowledge. And they were annexing non-knowledge. And it ruined everything when we actually learned about these things they were talking about. I should think they should be embarrassed and humbled, and maybe ought to take a second look at the paradigm, the whole evolutionary way of thinking about science.
Mm. Another thing I wanted to hear about is pseudogenes. What are those, and how does this fit into this whole junk DNA argument?
Well, my pretty much understanding on pseudogenes is these are things that look like a gene that might have been active in the past, and they're not. Now, the most famous one is the vitamin C gene that humans carry. Now, it's actually a gene that isn't doing anything now. Maybe it broke down from a mutation generations ago. Maybe before Noah got on the ark. And maybe everyone on the ark carried the pseudogene. Now, it looks a lot like the same gene in other mammals that actually manufactures vitamin C. The only mammals that don't manufacture vitamin C are primates, you know, and fruit bats. Now, monkeys and people and fruit bats eat fruit, so they don't really need to make a lot of vitamin C. I mean, God even told Adam and Eve, eat the fruit, it's going to be your food. So humans and monkeys and fruit bats, pretty much fruit is a large part of the diet, and so we don't need to manufacture vitamin C, but dogs and wolves and bears and mice, they all make their own vitamin C. Now, they have a gene for doing that functions, we can find it, and it works. And we have a stretch in our DNA that looks a lot like that, but it's a little different. So evolutionists have tried to say, well, it was a gene for vitamin C making, and it got mutated and broken, and now it doesn't work. Now, it could be that it was some other kind of gene, and it just randomly changed into something else, or it just could be a broken gene that looks like the vitamin C gene. They really do not know what it used to look like, but they're looking for things like this, guided by the evolutionary paradigm. I'm not saying pseudogenes are in support of evolution anymore than any of other things they try to say support evolution that are just observations. So a pseudogene, at least in my understanding of it, is something that it doesn't really work, but it looks a lot like a gene in some other living thing that does work, so we just make the assumption that it used to be that, and now it's broken, and we still have it. But the fact of the matter is, if we've been sitting around having evolved from monkeys 6 million years ago, and that pseudogene broke that long ago or longer ago, it should have drifted way further from looking like the vitamin C gene than even this, because it would be completely neutral to natural selection, and so any mutations that occurred would actually stick, and copying errors, no matter what they were, would be permanent, and it wouldn't affect the organism at all, and wouldn't kill off any organisms. You'd think that it wouldn't be as nice and tidy a story as the evolutionary paradigm gives to the concept of pseudogenes. It's not meaningless. It's probably more meaningful in the argument between evolution and creation than transposons are, but it's way less meaningful than the junk DNA error the evolutionists have made.
Okay. So what do you think the bottom line take-home message here is as far as junk DNA is concerned?
Well, you had said to me before you'd hoped that we'd stick with things that the lay people could understand easily, and I think the easiest to understand layperson message is guiding your science by evolution is going to lead you the wrong way. Now, evolutionists aren't wrong about everything, But when it comes to Darwin's processes of, say, turning monkeys into people or bacteria into monkeys, when you're guided by those thinkings, you might accidentally stumble onto the right things, but surely not because of your evolutionary theories. As a matter of fact, your evolutionary theory, because it's wrong, will lead you the wrong way. Only by luck are you going to get the right way, not by design, not by because you're thinking correctly. So the big take-home lesson is evolutionary thinking ends up with wrong conclusions that the reality, real science, later finds out that the trust they put in this theory to guide them is hugely misplaced trust. Evolution is not a smart theory. It doesn't guide you into the truth. And this should be a smack of cold water in the face to them, but it's not. Because this is their religion. It is not their science. It's where they get their idea about how the whole world has meaning or doesn't have meaning, and how they justify their own view of life and how to do life, how to do science, how to either do religion or condemn religion. And it is a religion. Evolution isn't a science at all. It's a superstition. I've never put it that way, but evolution and evolutionary thinking is totally fraught with superstitious ways of doing science, superstitious ways of making supposedly wise commentary on what it means to be human and why we're here and things like this. It's worse than religious. It's superstitious. So the big thing that lay people can take from this is evolutionary thinking has guided scientists in the wrong direction over and over and over and over again, but they just don't get it, and they just won't give up on it because they're extremely faithful in this religious belief. Now, there are some of the more technical ideas is that this vast networking in the DNA just shows more and more evidence of not just design, but vast, unimaginable design that we've only scratched the surface on. Literally, God only knows how much intricacy we're going to discover if we continue looking into the DNA. So that's a little bit more technical, but the take-home lesson is that the truth will set you free. And the truth we found out through scientific research should have set evolution is free from evolution, but it certainly sets creation is free from that mocking. They're not going to do it anymore. They're going to deny they ever did it, but we all lived through it for 30 or 40 years, and they're just going to say, we never were that serious about this, and trying to save face is what evolutionists have to do several times every decade, and it's getting worse for them. So no wonder they're often very mean-spirited. It's because they're really, really embarrassed. Mm.
Would you suggest that, if any of my listeners want to dig deeper here and learn more about junk DNA, is there any books you would suggest they read?
There's not a whole lot that's written on it. You're not going to find anything in high school or college textbooks saying anything bad about junk DNA. It'll take at least 10 years before the textbooks start admitting that it isn't proof of evolution. And teachers, especially high school teachers, because the college professors have to give it up first, and they train the high school teachers. Many, many teachers are teaching these kinds of things because they trusted their teachers and professors. But the professors have got to change it now, now the truth is known. As far as what you could read, there are some good books in the creationist literature that are for the lay people, written on the high school reading level would be Gary Parker's book, Creation, Facts of Life. It explains a lot about how DNA actually works and why the creationary paradigm is a lot better at explaining this than the evolutionary paradigm, which runs into a lot of tangled knots and messes along the way. Also, as I mentioned, John Sanford's book, Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, addresses more the idea of mutations and neutral mutations and how the accumulation of these mutations that natural selection just can't weed out fast enough will gradually cause any species to go extinct a lot sooner than how long evolutionists think species have existed on this planet. Let's see. If you really want to get into it technical about DNA and creation science, you could read Walter Remine's book, The Biotic Message. It's a big, thick book, kind of expensive and technical, but it really brings out the personification of God in our DNA. It's almost like God is just shouting, I'm the one behind all of this. When you look at what Walter Remine called the biotic message, a little simpler thing on DNA that puts it forth is the German creationist Werner Gitt wrote the book In the Beginning Was Information, and this is a lot more straightforward about information science and how the fact that DNA does contain real information on how to build a living thing just throws in the face of any atheist or anyone who wants to say that there's no sign that there's design. That's also a shorter book, easier to read, and also shows that Bill Nye was lying when he said that creation science is merely an American phenomenon. Bill Nye knew when he said that it was a lie, and he said it on Big Talk. And then what did he do? He went and debated an Australian creationist.
Another book that I keep running into as I was studying up for today is a book by Jonathan Wells, The Myth of Junk DNA. It looks like it's written on somewhat of a semi-technical level, but something that many people will understand, and it's actually fairly well-priced on Amazon, so that's another one I'd like to mention.
Oh, yeah, and if Wells wrote it, yeah, that would be, I haven't seen that one. I think I have heard of it now you mentioned it. What year did he write that, do you know?
May 31st, 2011.
2011. Well, he wouldn't have had the media explosion in the scientific world of there is no junk DNA, but all of the underpinnings were in place in 2005 and 2007. So, yeah, he would have enough to make an extremely good case. And if that's short and easy to read, some of his other things, like Icons of Evolution, I think he wrote that one. That would be good for lay people, yes.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one. More of an old Earth position, if I remember right, but still very fun.
Well, yes, he's more well-known as being in the intelligent design movement. But, hey, the intelligent design people are correct. And you take it 9 yards further, you know, the rest of the 9 yards, and you're in the biblical creation camp.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. It's a nice gateway into young Earth creationism, and but it gives you a place to start. And I appreciate the movement. I really do.
They gave us our second day in court. Is what they did for us, and it did help open the eyes of a lot of people.
Yep. All right, so your website, creationtruth.com, correct?
Yes. I work for Creation Truth Foundation. There's a website, as you mentioned, and also a Facebook page of the name Creation Truth Foundation.
And didn't you have your own blog as well? Did you want me to mention that as well?
Well, I have a blog page at thecreationtruth.com, and it's got a lot of very useful short essays on topics that you might be interested in. More now, I'm video blogging at the Facebook page for Creation Truth Foundation.
Okay, so yeah, friends, go ahead and look that up. Go on to Facebook and look for Creation Truth Foundation. And I've watched many of your videos, Dr. J, and they are fantastic. Very good. So.
Oh, well, thank you. Little video blogs are only a couple minutes each, but also there you can find the hour-long video DVDs that are, you know, you can view them online for free. Dr. G. Thomas Sharp, who's the president and founder of Creation Truth Foundation, also his videos are there too.
Excellent. So, all right. Well, Dr. J, thanks for coming on the podcast tonight and talking to us.
Okay, and thank you for having me, Michael, and God bless you.
All right, so there you have it. Dr. Charles Jackson, friends, if you'd like to learn more about what Dr. J is doing, creationtruth.com. That's creationtruth.com. Thanks for listening. I love you guys, and I'll see you next week.